Köszöntöm nézőinket, szervusztok! Donald Trump második elnöki ciklusának a beiktatásának a napjára egy különleges interjúval készültünk a számotokra. Elfogadta meghívásunkat Ben Rhodes, amerikai politikai kommentátor, író, a Pod Save the World podcast társműsorvezetője, illetve az Obama kormányban a stratégiai kommunikációért és beszédírásért felelős egykori nemzetbiztonsági tanácsadó helyettes. Vele fogunk beszélgetni arról, hogy alapvetően hogyan érdemes olvasnunk Trump második győzelmét, egyáltalán mit árul el a demokrata pártról az a helyzet, amiben lavírozták magukat ezzel a veszteséggel, és milyen kiutak mutatkoznak mindebből a számukra. De természetesen beszélgetni fogunk majd a következő Trump ciklus külpolitikai irányvonalairól és Trump, illetve Orbán barátságáról, leginkább pedig arról, hogy ez a barátság elégséges lesz-e ahhoz, hogy áthidalja azokat az ellentmondásokat, amelyek természetesen nehezítik ezt a viszonyt, hiszen Orbánnak megvan a maga Kína politikája, van egy meglehetősen különutas EU politikája, és ezek bizony nem mindig találkoznak azokkal az irányvonalakkal, amelyek jelenleg kirajzolódni látsznak Trump második elnöki ciklusában. Szóval számos fontos kérdés, amikkel kapcsolatban képbe szeretnél kerülni, akkor mindenképpen hallgass meg ezt az interjút. Tehát most következik Ben Rhodes. I would like to talk to you about two broader subjects related to the recent US presidential elections and Donald Trump's return to the White House on the 20th of January. On one hand, I would like to ask you about the lessons of Trump's second victory. And on the other hand, I would like to talk about the implications of this victory on US foreign policy, with a specific focus on Europe and, of course, on Hungary. So first, shortly after the November election, you published an essay in the New York Times about the reasons why Donald Trump and the Republican Party managed to defeat the Democrats. In your view, what are the principal explanation for this outcome?
Well, first of all, it's a bad time in democracies to be an incumbent. And so we should start there. I mean, last year, the quote unquote year of the election in 2024, I think was the first year on record where every party in a democracy that was the governing party lost vote share. Cost of living is high. There are immigration issues all over the world that are causing tensions. There's global instability. It's just not a good time to be an incumbent. Yeah. And so we can't ignore that reality here. And frankly, that hurt Donald Trump in 2020. But I was also quite critical of the Democrats in some ways. I think that Democrats have been slow to speak to the anger that Americans have with the way in which the system is working in the United States. Inequality is getting bigger, power is getting more concentrated. There's a sense that institutions aren't working for people, are not responsive to people. And one of the challenging things for Democrats is that we defend institutions, particularly since Donald Trump's emergence. We defend democracy. We defend, you know, and I was critical of this. I don't think it was the right decision. You know, we defend the national security apparatus in the United States. We defend norms. We defend the government itself that people are angry at. And so in some ways, I think Democrats walked into a trap where we're the defenders of an establishment that people think is not working for them. And frankly, a lot of those problems I talked about, Democrats have policies to address them, and Republicans don't. When you talk about things like inequality, in particular economic inequality, when you talk about cost of living. But I think that the mood in the country is so angry that when we're the ones that are defending the government, we're the ones who are defending the established way of doing things, you become seen as responsible for a lot of the things that people don't like. Hmm. And a guy like Donald Trump who comes along and just wants to tear everything down, well, that becomes attractive to some people. And look, there are a number of Americans who just love Donald Trump, but not enough for him to win an election. What gets him over that hump is that sense that the Democrats just don't get it. We're angry. We want something different. And I think this has been building for a long time since the financial crisis, which bring Orbán to office in Hungary, the sense that the whole system of globalization isn't working for people. And, you know, here we are. And the last thing I should say is, you know, Joe Biden should not have run for re-election. He was too old, and everybody could see that. And if you're arguing, as the Democrats were, that our entire democracy is at stake, why would you then nominate someone or let someone run for re-election who's going to be, you know, 86 years old at the end of his second term. It kind of undercut the trust that people had in Democrats. So even though Kamala Harris stepped in, I think it was probably too late for her to overcome that.
If I understand you correctly, right now and by your article, you are pointing to the fact of the Democratic Party is sort of a last defender of neoliberalism and also espousing an elitist technocratic way of doing politics. This sounds to me very much like the criticism shared by Bernie Sanders already back in 2016. So can we say with confidence that Bernie was right?
I don't agree with every single thing Bernie Sanders says, but you know, if I look back on the last 8 years since I left government, the biggest what if to me is what if Bernie Sanders had been the nominee in 2016? Because, you know, I think this time around, Bernie would have been too old to run, just like Biden. But in 2016, he was tapping into the same kind of populism. You know, we are living in a populist era, and Democrats have been running establishment candidates in a populist era. Barack Obama, I worked on both Obama campaigns. He won overwhelmingly, and he was an outsider. He was not a political insider. He was a guy that came out of nowhere in 2008. He'd only been in the U.S. Senate for 4 years. If you look at who the Democrats have put up since, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and then Kamala Harris is kind of a late entry, but you can't find more establishment figures than Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. They're almost tailor-made for Donald Trump to run against. So I do think Bernie was right that, look, Democrats are not going to have the populism of Orban and Trump. We are not going to demonize immigrants. We're not going to try to create an us versus them politics. We're not going to kind of violate the rules and norms of how democracy works. Our populism has to be an economic populism. And that's what I think Bernie was right about. And, you know, if you don't show that you get that the system needs to change for people, it needs to be, if not broken, it needs to be reformed, then I think you're going to have a hard time winning an election in this environment.
There is another thing I'm really interested in about your opinion. So since 2016, we can say with confidence that the Republican Party underwent a substantial political shift, while at the same time, the push is to alter the course of the Democratic Party were systematically blocked. I'm not just mentioning the way which the Bernie movement was treated by the party elite, but also the warnings related to the cost of living crisis and the Biden policy on Gaza, which was also, you were very critical with these policies. So what do you think makes the Democratic Party less capable of political self-correction?
I think it's a very good question. I mean, I think part of it is, you know, it's interesting when Obama was elected and obviously was president for 8 years, he was obviously the leader of the Democratic Party. But I never kind of felt that he took full control of it. You know, there'd been, you know, the Clintons had been running that party for a long time. Hillary Clinton maintained presidential ambitions. Obama was focused on doing the job. And I should also say Obama was such a big figure that he took up a lot of space. And that did not allow time for like a new generation to emerge and get a national profile. And so when you look at the party since Obama left office, a simple answer would be that there are a lot of people that just didn't want to leave the scene. And if you talk about the Clintons, if you talk about, I should say, I like some of these people, but just generationally, our leadership for the last 8 years has been Nancy Pelosi in the House of Representatives, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton. These are older people that I think are not as in touch with the concerns of not only younger voters, but, you know, but voters who are much more open to radical change. And so part of it was a party elite that wasn't willing to kind of pass the baton to the next generation until too late. I mean, Joe Biden did that, but he didn't do it until this summer. And then another part of it is, look, like any political party, you have donors, political donors that, you know, are invested in a neoliberal system. And so, you know, the Democratic Party is slow to change. It's not, you know, it's not quite as bad as where the Hungarian left was and the Hungarian governing party was in 2010. But it's some of the same problems of just a kind of governing elite that got too out of touch with the people and couldn't figure out how to to kind of hand things over to a new generation that was closer to public opinion.
By your assessment, what would be the way forward for the Democratic Party, and who could be the leader to manage such a course correction for the party?
So first of all, I think it's a real one of the problems with Biden choosing to run again is that if we had had an open primary, I think there are actually a lot of good Democrats who are around my age, you know, people in their 40s, who are governors, people like Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, Wes Moore in Maryland, you know, J.B. Pritzker in Illinois. There's a lot of younger governors who've done interesting things. And going forward, I should say that I would be looking outside of Washington. You know, I think this is really important. Not a senator, not a congressman. Maybe you know, there's good people in Congress, so I don't want to rule that out. But people that are out in the country and that are closer to things like the cost of living crisis, the lack of affordable housing in this country, the sense of growing inequality in this country. So I'd be looking beyond Washington itself. I made the point in that New York Times article that I was actually impressed when I wrote my book and kind of studied Orban and his rise at what he did with civic circles. You know, get out there and listen to people. You know, Obama did this quite well. Like when he was running in 2008, that was a two-year campaign. The first year, he was just traveling. He was going into people's living rooms. He was going into people's kitchens. He was going into factories. And so not only did that have a good political message, you know, here he is out with the people, but he got better as a candidate. If you look at Barack Obama at the beginning of 2007 and at the end of 2008, one of the reasons why he got so much better is that he listened to people and therefore he could reflect their concerns and talk about the things that they were angry about. If you talk about a Joe Biden, you know, he'd been in Washington for 50 years. Matter how good a politician or good a man he is, you're not going to be in touch with what's going on in people's lives.
I'm exceptionally curious whether you have an explanation why the Biden administration kept to a disastrous policy in Gaza.
I've been very critical of their Gaza policy. I think it's been a catastrophe, a humanitarian disaster. It's undermined the argument that Biden's tried to make about a rules-based order, because why do we give ourselves and Israel a complete exemption from the rules that we try to apply to Russia and other countries? In terms of why, I think ultimately it's the president. And I think it's connected to what we were just talking about. You know, Joe Biden was shaped by a different era where, you know, where the Israeli government, you know, whatever you think of Israel generally, this Israeli government is the most right-wing Israeli government in history. And, you know, I think Joe Biden thought, you know, and he said, what you do is you embrace Israel and then that gives you influence over them. And I think that misreads Netanyahu. You embrace Netanyahu and he just keeps pushing further and further and further. Like that unwillingness to publicly break from Netanyahu ultimately gave him a blank check. And I think that's because Biden is living in a past where the Israeli government was not this right wing. And I also, you know, I think that, again, you know, Joe Biden was a bit out of touch with how Gaza was not only a catastrophe on its own, but how it seemed to suggest a president who just didn't get it, who was kind of out of touch, who didn't understand what younger people were concerned about, what younger people were even seeing on social media. And it's led us, I think, to a really tragic situation.
Okay, so let's talk about some possible policy directions of the second Donald Trump term. So there is an interesting tension within the America First foreign policy that Donald Trump espouses. On the one hand, it contains an isolationist impulse that could potentially diminish U.S. hegemony in international relations. But on the other hand, it also entails a very direct and, let's say, aggressive pursuit of U.S. national interest. In other words, an impulse to strengthen U.S. hegemony. So how do you see this tension playing out in the following years? Will Donald Trump be an imperialist or an isolationist?
I think that he's going to be more aggressive in his second term than his first. I don't think, you know, here's how he's isolationist. In the past, you know, U.S. hegemony or U.S., you know, imperialism or U.S. superpower policies have been kind of channeled through the system that we helped build, right? So you kind of try to channel U.S. power through our network of alliances, through NATO, through the G7, through the G20, through other institutions. Trump will not do that. So he's an isolationist in that he's going to act by himself to impose tariffs on countries, whatever military policies he pursues. That doesn't mean that he doesn't care about the rest of the world. And so I do think what you're going to see is an era of transactionalism and an era in which the U.S. kind of throws its weight around through the use of tariffs and economic coercion. I expect him to do all those things. He's made these threats around things like the Panama Canal and Greenland. You know, I kind of take that seriously. Like, I'm not suggesting he's going to go to war about those things on day one. But I think, you know, we've seen these aging autocratic leaders of large powers, whether it be, you know, Putin most extremely in Russia, you know, you start to get some territorial ambition or you start to want to, I don't know, create some legacy. So I worry a little bit about, despite his isolationist tendencies, you know, him really, you know, being willing to break things, you know, pushing with tariffs, pressuring other countries. So I just think it could be a very bumpy ride for the next 4 years.
For us Europeans, one of the greatest questions is related to the situation in Ukraine. In your opinion, what are the chances of ceasefire being agreed in 2025? And what is the most probable chain of events that would take us there?
Trump will definitely try to, you know, broker some settlement or, you know, he wants to show that he's ending the war. He wants to not be supplying Ukraine with $60 to $70 billion in assistance a year. But he's not the only person who gets a vote, you know, Zelensky and the Ukrainians and Putin were ultimately the people that have to resolve this. So what Trump does is change the dynamic a bit where there's probably some greater urgency, some new urgency on the Ukrainian side to negotiate something because they can't necessarily count on U.S. military assistance in kind of an open-ended, as Joe Biden said, as much as it takes for as long as it takes. So if anything, I think what is possible in 2025 is a negotiated settlement that is probably freezing the conflict. I don't see Ukraine and Russia, you know, reaching some long-term understanding. But it might be in everybody's interest. You know, it's in Russia's interest to freeze a conflict where they kind of can consolidate control over territory that they have. Ukraine is, you know, I think been exhausted by the war and frankly is having trouble holding the front line. And Russia is suffering huge losses. And so if there's a negotiated settlement, I think it's probably something that looks like a frozen conflict, with the question being, does Ukraine get security guarantees from the West? What they want is NATO membership. I don't think Trump is going to offer that. Hmm. And so can you piece together enough assurances for Ukraine that they're getting something out of a frozen conflict where they don't have to fear Russia just kind of resuming the war in a couple of years? And so that, to me, is going to be a big question.
There are analysts and political actors like the former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett who claim that shortly after the outbreak of the war back in 2022, there was a realistic chance for a peace settlement, but the Biden administration discouraged this. What's your read on the results of U.S. policy in Ukraine? Did it just prolong the conflict without altering the outcome, or did it achieve something more?
I've seen all those reports. I'm kind of skeptical. The Russians might have been saying that. The Russians might have been saying, yeah, we're willing to talk. But I've been involved in this Ukraine issue for a decade, and Vladimir Putin has never kept his word, you know. Yeah. And so so I'm a little skeptical about how real that might have been as a potential. Look, I think the Biden administration did a lot good in the sense that they, you know, Ukraine could have collapsed as a sovereign state without U.S. military assistance. The Ukrainians ultimately are the ones that showed the bravery and the courage to stay and fight. But without that huge influx of U.S. military aid, they would have had a hard time doing it. That's the success is Ukraine was able to stay a sovereign country, even if they end up losing some territory. They have the potential to be a strong, sovereign, successful country that is able to integrate with Europe. That would be the success. I think the failure of the policy was the Biden team kind of got stuck in the middle. They never really, you know, gave the Ukrainians everything they wanted on the timeline that the Ukrainians wanted it. They gave them enough to kind of hold on in the fight. But the Russians are bigger and have more people to throw at this. And if you look at the history of Russian wars, this is what they do. They try to grind down their opponents. And so I think the challenge for the failure of the Biden policy was this, you know, not being decisive about, are we just going to give them everything they want and see if they can take back this territory as fast as we can? Or should we try to get this into a diplomatic negotiation faster? And I'm sympathetic. This is hard. And I think, again, there's a lot of good that the Biden people did. But right now, it's a difficult circumstance for the Ukrainians.
And for the final part of our interview, and I'm really thankful for your generosity with your time, I would like to pick your brain for a couple of issues related with Hungary. There is a visible friendship between Viktor Orban and Donald Trump. Viktor Orban is instrumentalizing this friendship, both in domestic politics, but also on the EU level. However, since Trump's re-election, a long line of other European politicians are trying to elbow their way into Trump's favor. What are the chances for Orban, representing a relatively small country, to gain special attention from the new administration?
The way to think about this is not that there's some, you know, specific love for Viktor Orban. It's just that the Trump and the people around him are a part of this kind of global right-wing ethno-nationalist collection of people, right? Netanyahu, Orban, the AfD in Germany, to some extent Meloni, although she's not, you know, I wouldn't say she's all in that category because of her stance on Russia. Mele in Argentina, you know, Bolsonaro was on this list in Brazil. So again, it's not specific to Orban. There's a type of leader right now in the world and a type of political party that Trump and Steve Bannon and Elon Musk like. And Orban happens to be one of those people. And he's, you know, built a relationship over time. I don't think that's going to bring any practical benefit to Hungarians, though. I mean, It means that Viktor Orban's going to get invited to Mar-a-Lago. It means that Viktor Orban's going to get invited to the White House. It means that Donald Trump will say nice things about Viktor Orban. But to what end for Hungarians? It's good for Orban. It's not good for Hungarians. You know, it's not like Hungary is going to get, you know, trade preferences or investment from the U.S. Again, it probably does increase Orban's stature. He's this guy who can get his phone call returned at the White House. He's buddies with Trump and Elon and Tucker Carlson and whatever. But again, I wouldn't overstate it because I don't really know what practically it means for Hungary.
And despite the performative harmony between the two, Orban is also building close ties with China and argues against the emergence of a new Cold War between the U.S. and China. Do you think the anti-China hawkishness of the Trump team can cause problems to Budapest's China policy?
Yeah, there are contradictions, and I think people aren't quite sure how this is going to play out. Because Orban has gotten a lot of investment from China, and that's the kind of thing that people like Marco Rubio would usually want to target and say, don't do that. And it is possible that, like I was saying, Orban could use his relationship to avoid pressure. And so that's probably the biggest practical benefit is Orban can pick up the phone and say, hey, when you want to punish countries about China, punish the Germans, don't punish us. And I think that is probably how this would play out.
And do you think that Mark Rubio's position on Hungary, because he was very critical with the state of the rule of law in this country, so do you think that Orban has to bear in mind that Mark Rubio will not be as favorable with Hungary as Donald Trump is?
Honestly, I don't think it matters. I think Donald Trump is going to be calling the shots on foreign policy, and Rubio knows that. And the deal is that Rubio gets that job, but he's not going to take positions that run counter to what Trump wants.
In November, reports by the Central European investigative website, WeSquare, citing Hungarian government sources, claimed that the cash-strapped Hungarian cabinet had calculated that Trump's victory would enable Hungary to free ride on NATO security without heavily investing in defense. This is a puzzling calculation if we take into account Trump's tirades against European states not contributing enough to NATO's budget. Do you have any knowledge that would explain Viktor Orban's calculation in this respect?
I think he's wrong about this, because this is something that Trump really cares about. You know, and I don't think Orban is close enough to Trump that he can get a pass from this. Trump is obsessed with this issue. He talks about it constantly. And by the way, the other Eastern Europe, the Baltic states, are going to be telling him, hey, we're spending 2, 3, 4% on defense. Look at the Hungarians. And here, this is one where I don't think Orban's relationship, because it clashes with a leading Trump priority. I don't think Hungary gets a pass from Trump.
And my very last additional question, sorry for that, but I'm very curious, because in Hungary, we are very much obsessed with the relationship between Trump and Orban, and we are very much focusing on and explaining U.S. politics through this ally between the two politicians. So what would be your suggestion for the Hungarian public? What should we focus on in the upcoming months and years of the Trump's presidency, the Trump's cabinet, which would really tell a lot about the nature of this new cabinet?
I'd focus on what they do, not what they say. Like, one of the reasons Trump likes to hang out with Orban is because it angers liberals. You know, like, and people like me get upset, right? I don't think he has some deep interest in Hungary, or I don't think he's, you know, read Orban's speeches. And, you know, there are other people like Steve Bannon who have, and Tucker Carlson. So look at what he does. Just because Viktor Orban's at Mar-a-Lago doesn't mean much, right? What does he do with tariffs? What does he do on defense spending? What does he do on Ukraine? Trump creates a lot of show. My advice is to look at the actions and not get distracted by the show.
Ben Rhodes, thank you very much for your time, and thank you very much for expanding on these issues for the Hungarian public. Good luck to you. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks so much.
Ez volt tehát az interjúm Ben Rhodes-zal, nagyon szépen köszönöm, hogy meghallgattál bennünket. Ha szeretnéd további ilyen tartalmakat nézni, illetve hallgatni, akkor mindenképpen kövesd a Partizánt itt a YouTube-on, illetve a további podcast felületeinken is. Ha pedig szeretnéd, hogy tudjunk további ilyen tartalmakat készíteni, akkor kérlek, hogy szállj be a finanszírozásunkba a leírásban található lehetőségen keresztül. Munkatársaim nevében köszönöm szépen a megtisztelő figyelmed, én Gulyás Márton voltam, hamarosan találkozunk, addig is ciao.